Democracia e liberdade só existe quando a sua respectiva Forças Armadas assim o quer.
You know I'm totally off script right now.
I want to be nasty. Do you mind? Do you mind? We're going to have the wall. We're building the wall. We're building the wall, folks. We're building the wall.
Aaj jo partiya yahan shor macha rahi hai.
Através do voto, você não vai mudar nada nesse país. Nada. Absolutamente nada.
And the reality now is that we are the party of the people.
Hello there, and welcome to Season 3 of PowCast, the podcast of the Project on Autocratic Legalism, or POW. I'm Fabio de Saia Silva at the University of Oklahoma. POW is an academic network dedicated to understanding how rising autocrats employ the law to consolidate power, sideline political opponents, and govern without constraints, and what can be done to resist those moves, if anything at all. For more information about the project, visit autocratic-legalism.net. My three guests today are Conrad Sartorius, Caleb Weisinger, and David Titano. They are students in the Masters of International Affairs program at the University of Oklahoma. I had the joy of having Conrad and Caleb in a course I just taught for the program titled, Guess What? Autocratic Legalism. In that course, I explored in the classroom the issues you hear about often on this podcast, that democracy has been under attack around the world, and that the law has been used by rising autocrats to consolidate power and suppress oppositions or dissenters. We reviewed how this dynamic plays out in different cases before students could develop their own research on a country of their choosing. This was a fun course to teach, which received very generous feedback from students and which seems to have had a longer-lasting impact on them. Because a few weeks after the semester was over, I was thrilled to hear that Conrad and Caleb had built on what they learned in the course to develop a project for another course, which they named Democratic Legalism. In that project, they mapped vulnerabilities in the U.S. constitutional order which would make the country more susceptible to autocratic leadership, and proposed legal changes that could make the U.S. system more resilient against such threats. David was not in my course, but he attended a guest lecture that I gave on autocratic legalism, got interested in this subject, and joined Conrad and Caleb in their project. As listeners know, I'm always passionate about bringing students onto the show, because I find it fundamental to track how our academic arguments about, in this case, the nexus between law and politics may impact their lives, not just as aspiring scholars or professionals, but also as citizens. Today's episode delivers plenty of that. We begin with a discussion about what drew these students to studies of democracy, and how much attention they had paid to the nexus between law and democracy before my course, or in the case of David, before he engaged in the project on democratic legalism with his peers. We move on to a discussion about their project itself, that is, the points of vulnerability they identify in the U.S. constitutional system and their proposed remedies. We then engage in a very lively conversation about the role and the limits of law in safeguarding democracy, recognizing that closing gaps in constitutional design alone may be insufficient to shield a country like the US from authoritarian leadership, but also recognizing that there are still strong and important reasons why we should care about building such legal resilience in democracies. All in all, I'm very proud of these students and grateful for the opportunity to have prompted them to consider these issues. And I hope their story will serve as an inspiration to other faculty around the world who want to foster similar conversations in their classrooms. Here's the interview. Conrad, Caleb, David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having us. It's a real pleasure to be on your podcast. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I want to start with a general question about your backgrounds. Can you share with the audience some details of your trajectories?
My name is Conrad Sartorius. I'm a former social studies teacher who's now returning to graduate school to try to reboot my career because I ultimately want to pursue some sort of a career in like either the State Department or other forms of government service. And so that's kind of how I got into, this graduate program and then ultimately into Dr. Silva's autocratic legalism course.
I'm Caleb Weisinger. I'm straight from my undergraduate. I got a bachelor's degree in history and political science, and I'm seeking a master's degree in global studies at OU.
My background is I'm originally from Oklahoma City. I'm an older student, so an unconventional student. I'm 41 years old. I graduated high school probably 2001 and joined the Marine Corps for almost 15 years and served during the global war on terrorism. Got out for a while and worked and got to a place where I felt like I was comfortable to go to college. And so I started going to college, and I'm now in my second semester of the master's program in international studies at OU.
You're part of a master's program that gives you the chance to learn about and attend classes on many issues. Why did you decide to pick a class that is about politics? Where does your interest in politics and democracy come from?
I'll start with history. So my interest in history started pretty young because I just enjoyed reading about the topic. And well, politics, of course, is a core component of studying history. And so pretty much as long as I've been reading about history, I've had a, you know, contingent interest in politics. In terms of like democracy, more specifically, my exact rationale for, you know, supporting democracy or individual rights has evolved over time as my philosophical beliefs have shifted. But I mean, I pretty consistently believe that it's a good thing and it needs to be defended because I just believe it's necessary for, you know, enabling individuals to, you know, achieve like self-actualization and, you know, individual fulfillment, to have like individual liberty and, of course, governments which respect that.
Shortly after I turned 18, I got really into politics and really into the idea of democracy. I would consider democracy kind of the core of my political ideology. It is the most important factor for me whenever like people are doing stuff.
I guess my interest in politics is that you know, we shape the world around us through politics, and it's part of our responsibility to stay engaged with what's going on in our communities and in our country. So democracy, I guess through studies, you know, we really consider that, you know, because a lot of when countries become democracies, they tend to stay democracies for a long time, you know, and the benefits of democracy is something that, you know, I think researchers look at when looking at different countries. And, you know, it's fair. It's a way that includes multiple, you know, includes diverse groups and everything. And it's a way where people are represented. And so, you know, for me, it's proven that democracies offer more rights to citizens for the most part.
And what about the relationship between law and democracy? Is this something that you had thought more deeply about previously, or is it something that you came to think about after our interaction in the classroom, for those of you who took my course, or you know, more punctually in other encounters that we had?
Like, I had thought of it before. I had written similar projects about, we're close to the idea of autocratic legalism without using those words. But I would say that your class helped me think about it in a much more organized way that really had me look at like how at a global level people are sharing the same strategies more than I even initially thought. I'd seen Hungary and Poland share certain things. I'd heard that these different autocratic legalists had been sharing ideas. I just did not know to what extent.
I mean, the concept of laws being used to undermine and erode democratic governance is something that I think first drew my attention during like the mid-2010s. Because I mean, Fried Zakaria back in 2016 had a really good segment about this topic on a show for CNN, in which he talked about how, you know, Freedom House has consistently documented a consistent decline in democratic governance and the quality of democracy in dozens of countries around the world in the last decade. And so that kind of got me interested in, first of all, reading about Freedom House, but also reading about the, you know, literature on democratic backsliding. And it's far more stark than I realized. And so that caused me to take an interest in examining like what methods can be used either to strengthen or weaken individual liberty and democratic governance, which that's the origin story for me.
Well, obviously, in democratic societies, people choose their own laws and everything. And I think the law is important, you know. Well, I don't know. In this group, we were having some friction going back and forth about law and democracy. Because, you know, through democracy, I guess we got to the point to where we're talking about like things are normal or things are norms, right? And I guess some of the disagreement was if laws protect the norms or norms protect the laws. I thought that the norms protect the laws. And we're talking about election. Somehow it came up election interference. How come, you know, more people don't intimidate poll workers? We were debating about it. And I said, well, we don't have police in every polling location in the United States. You know, I mean, you don't need to make a law to make security for that, because nobody's really going to do anything to the poll workers. I mean, all their locations are within churches, and you're not going to do something to somebody. You're not going to make a public threat in a church around community leaders, because it's illegal and everybody in the community is going to support the norm. It's not the law protecting, it's the norm protecting, you know. And so I thought that was interesting. And that's where we were with democracy and law, is that, you know, we were kind of within our group. I took a different route. They went with the legalistic approach, and I wanted something that didn't involve the lawyers as much.
And that leads to one of the topics that I would like to bring up in this interview, which is this project that you put together for another course, I guess with some inspiration from the discussions that we had in the classroom in my course, and which was called Democratic Legalism. Can you explain what the project was about?
I think this was Caleb's brainchild, and so I'll let him take the lead on like explaining like where does it come from, because it was a really cool idea, and I fell in love with it immediately as soon as he proposed it in class.
So this was for our like introductory colloquium course that we have in the College of International Area Studies. This project was kind of everyone in the class had to propose one, and at a certain point in the course, we would have to narrow it down to everybody joining groups of three. So my idea ended up winning over David's and Conrad's. David had a somewhat related idea. My idea was that I wanted to look at, from a more international level, what could be done to strengthen democracies, what big policies we could propose that would possibly help to strengthen democracies, kind of inspired by some of the things I'd been seeing around the world. Slovakia passed a law stating that the government had very little to do with the government-run media, which kind of would prevent some of the stuff that happened in Hungary and Poland. And I was interested enough in that to say, well, why can't other laws be passed?
Conrad, it looks like you want to add something.
It was about the topic of like what were the other ideas, and I found them pretty interesting. So, like in the case of like David, for example, he proposed saying, "Hey, like, you know, there needs to be a, you know, public relations campaign to warn people about how democratic backsliding occurs."
Yeah, so I didn't take your course. So I had some catching up to do, and I was coming from a different perspective than the other students that were in your course. So I thought that was interesting. So the article that I read the most, or that I really liked, was the Kim Lane Chappelle article. And I read it differently. One of the first meetings that we had with a group is, I think Caleb didn't feel like she had given a good enough answer, like just pointing to education as being a solution to the threat of democratic backsliding wasn't a good enough answer for the rest of my group. And so I wanted to take education and see, you know, if education was a viable approach. My initial pitch, project pitch, was that we come up with graphical representations of how autocratic legalism works. I try to stay, I don't know if that makes any sense, I try to stay kind of where I was going in the project.
And I argued my paper could be over something completely separate from the whole democracy thing. I at this point, I was thinking, you know, I'm just going to write like a paper, give a presentation arguing, hey, the way we approach like the history of the Iraq War should be like fundamentally like recentered away from, you know, the U.S. and towards Iraq, because I think it's too America-centric, at least the public discourse on the conflict. And so that was a completely like, that's a whole separate, you know, interest that I have, and ultimately decided, actually, Caleb's one actually sounds cooler, and it aligns with something I also deeply care about. And so I just latched onto him and, you know, followed his idea.
But shortly after we started working on the project, we came across certain difficulties with my initial plan. So we decided to refocus more on American democracy as a core example, rather than using examples from around the globe.
Can you elaborate on the reasons why you chose to look at the U.S. as opposed to these other countries?
Both Conrad and David seemed more interested in looking at American laws. And I think America is a big enough example that was fresh enough in our minds and in our fellow classmates' minds that our project has the potential to look better because of it.
And one of the reasons why, like, me and David Perch were insisting on, like, only doing the U.S. is because, and the original idea is actually very cool, of, like, having, like, you know, like, kind of like a series of, like, you know, vignettes in which we talk about, like, different countries and, like, how different countries have taken measures to preemptively strengthen their democracy against authoritarian backsliding. Our main concern was, like, how do we, like, create, like, a unified narrative by, like, you know, tying together, like, you know, Slovenia, Greece, all these other different countries. And so we pretty much agree that, hey, it might be better just to focus on one country. That way we can, like, put a detailed focus on how, like, all the different systems and rules, you know, interlock with each other and how they, like, mutually support or don't mutually support each other. And so that's kind of like why we shifted the focus.
Well, the reason why I'm asking this is because, as you know, since you've read my scholarship, I've been arguing that the symbolic line that used to exist between the U.S. and the rest of the world, as far as democracy and the rule of law are concerned, has been blurred. For a long time, many scholars and activists working around these topics operated under the assumption, spoken or not, that the U.S. democracy was exceptionally consolidated and almost immune to authoritarian turns which affected younger or transitional democracies throughout the 20th century. But in the context of democratic backsliding and autocratic legalism, there has been a surge of studies about the U.S. which use the same categories that were previously used to name and measure regressive political development elsewhere. And to me, this is indicative of a change and a realization that, at least when it comes to those phenomena, it can happen here as well. I jokingly say about this that the U.S. has finally become another case in studies of comparative politics rather than, again, being an exception against which nobody could be compared. Does it make sense to read your project through this lens and to assume that you're driven by a concern that the U.S. might be facing at least the threat of backsliding, facilitated by imperfections in its constitutional texture? And if so, what are you proposing as remedies to fix those imperfections?
I mean, in terms of the idea that American democracy is backsliding, I mean, that's kind of, obviously, of course, a contentious argument. I mean, the main thesis of our project was that there are severe vulnerabilities to authoritarian backsliding, and that there's some limited examples of that already happening, like gerrymandering, for example, making like some states, in effect, one-party states, in effect, including, you know, Oklahoma, for example. I mean, one of the vulnerabilities that we focused on, of course, was the judicial system, because, of course, that's probably the single biggest impact of the autocratic legalism course upon our thinking, is focusing on the judiciary. And I mean, in the case of the United States, we have a very politicized process for selecting judges, whereby the president directly picks whoever they want, and then the Senate largely votes on party lines to either affirm or deny the nomination. And so that outsized role for the executive is probably like the single greatest vulnerability to judicial capture, which of course can then facilitate authoritarian power grabs.
Yeah, Conrad's focus for the paper was the judiciary, whereas I focus more on limiting presidential power and nonpartisan redistricting, both of which I felt were important facets of this in the U.S. I think one of the things that inspired me to think of the U.S. as like possible authoritarian, like as having authoritarian backsliding, is I forget which paper it was that we talked about that we had in your class about pockets of authoritarianism, which then means like Conrad's case of the judiciary having some pockets of authoritarianism in it, that and in my case, it was certain states have been gerrymandered to such an extent that no other party could ever win. Oklahoma is somewhat of an example of that, though I will say that even if we were not gerrymandered, we'd have a Republican supermajority. States like Wisconsin, on the other hand, have about a 50-50 split at presidential elections and statewide elections. However, the state legislature has made the borders of the districts so that they receive a supermajority in the state legislature. And that just kind of seems like a pocket of authoritarianism to me. They've also, in Wisconsin, restricted the power of the governor, who is another statewide race that sometimes the Democrats win, and moved a lot of that power onto the Speaker of the House in the state of Wisconsin.
We really had a lot of good debate in our class, a lot of back and forth on our project team. And it was about that because, you know, one of the first things that came up, obviously, was January 6th being you know, an indicator of a threat to democracy or an indicator that our system is safe. So that wasn't, you know, they were like, well, these people went into the Capitol, or, well, yeah, but the other side is it was completely ineffective. So did that strengthen resolve in democracy, or did it weaken democracy? And I think that's still playing out, you know, because some people could point at it as a success. Some people point at it as a failure. So I didn't get to that point, because I didn't see a lot of areas where making a law would benefit. And I went into education and I said, well, you know, where I ended up was, if there's a place in American society where people are using policy, which, you know, pretty much is using policy, just autocratically using policy to make things the way they want, it's in education in the United States. So my prescription was, and it's in Chappelle's article too, to look at civics. So I looked into civic education, which, you know, civic responsibility and civic duty among citizens has always been like a cornerstone of U.S. public education. And I think it's something that ultimately we're lacking on right now. So if there's already, you know, I wanted to educate about civic responsibility, civic duty. This is how the government works. This is how state government works. This is how local government works. This is what is out there, you know. So that was my prescription.
So that leads us back to the friction that you said that existed in your group before. And you seem to side with those who think that it's not the law that actually cements democracy, but it's unwritten norms of political conduct, you know, or politics more generally. Is that right?
Well, yeah, because I think Chappelle says, you know, the law is too important to be left in the hands of lawyers alone. It's like, so, and I agree with that, you know, and that's kind of within the, do norms support the laws or do laws support the norms? I think norms support the laws. So the law is too important to be left in the hands of lawyers alone. You know, I mean, if this is something that's, you know, the Constitution or our rights, our freedom, our democracy is important, then people need to be involved.
Well, you did not take my course, but that's an issue that we actually address in the course. And I'm actually very keen on highlighting the limitations of the law and the fact that, you know, we may think about the best legal design with which to structure our political system, but these laws that we may put in place are always subject to manipulation for, among other reasons, because there's always a degree of indeterminacy in legal norms that can be, exploited by those who want to subvert the meaning of law without, necessarily having to change the text of those laws. Caleb and Conrad, how do you respond to this critique? How do you make the case, and how do you convince me and David that it matters, nevertheless, to invest in strengthening the design of U.S. constitutional norms to make the U.S. political system more resilient against authoritarian attacks?
I will say that I think I view things in a similar way as you, but I think that authoritarian is similar to a virus, and that whenever it shows up, we have to build our defenses against it like you would for any illness, so that next time you get it, next time an authoritarian shows up and wants to take power, they will have a harder time of it. Therefore, we should look at our laws and try to build them up, as that is one of the routes they've decided to take, is the legal route in autocratic legalism. And if there's less things they can abuse, less places that they can get around the norms, at least without facing any repercussions, the less likely it is for authoritarianism to win. So any dedicated effort could overcome this if it took long enough. Just hopefully each time we go through authoritarianism, the harder it is for authoritarianism to actually take hold.
The distribution of power, matters. In terms of, like, of course, preventing authoritarianism and also slowing it when it happens. I mean, but another variable that also matters is also, like, the legitimacy of state actions. And so if, for example, an authoritarian act is a blatant breach of, say, the Constitution or of written law, there will be more resistance either within institutions or within the general public, because they will feel that they have a greater prerogative to resist what they regard as a criminal act. Whereas if an authoritarian action, for example, is legal or is done by the books, so to speak, then, of course, other branches of government don't have any leg to stand on to resist it. I mean, the courts can't yell that's unconstitutional if it's written into the Constitution, for example. And additionally, the public will largely acquiesce. This is where I'm a bit more cynical, is that the public will largely acquiesce to something so long as it's legal. And so, you know, building constitutional structures and legal regimes that prohibit certain authoritarian actions, like packing the courts or politicizing state media, for example, that will essentially prime the public to resist those actions when they do occur. And if you don't have those legal safeguards, the people will just acquiesce to it.
Yeah, that's definitely a good answer. But let's assume that stronger legal norms are needed or at least important for democracies to be able to resist authoritarian attacks. That, of course, doesn't exclude the need or the importance of extra legal actions, that is to say, actions from we, the people, right, to stand up in defense of that democracy. What do you think about this? What is our role in supporting democracy?
I'll say that I think that we, the people, like, can't do it alone within a democratic system. We have to have organizations and groups and people in government who are helping us. One person cannot go at this alone. It would requires a mass movement.
It may also, like, second that point. I mean, we also need, as a public, need to have, like, a frank conversation about what kind of a democracy we want to have. Because, and part of the reason why in the United States, so many people feel disengaged from the American political process and who don't really feel all that compelled to defend it, for example, from authoritarian populists, is that, you know, we have, like, have a two-party duopoly, in effect, where many people feel that, in effect, it doesn't really matter if they engage with it or not, because their perspective cannot be represented in government. And so, like, this is largely a product of, like, what kind of a democracy the U.S. has, namely that it's a presidential system with first-past-the-post voting. And if we want to essentially build a truly popular democracy that can, you know, truly claim to represent, you know, the full spectrum of political beliefs within the U.S. and therefore possess the legitimacy necessary to maintain, you know, public support for it, and we're likely going to need to, like, you know, adopt reforms that make it easier for third parties to participate, like proportional voting. Though, of course, that's more of a pipe dream in my view, because, of course, the only way to achieve that is through the two-party system reforming itself. So, I don't know. There's not really much that can be done on that front, I suspect.
And that's kind of why I focused on things I see as being slightly more possible, like nonpartisan redistricting. It's already a thing in several states, rather than trying to go with ranked choice voting, for an example, which is only currently being done in two states and a few municipalities.
I did not have this question on my list, but I'm not going to miss the chance to ask what you think about the next U.S. General elections and how they might impact the prospects for democracy in the country.
I thought our elections are pretty safe in America, you know, just our election process. I work as a poll worker, so I know a little bit about elections. So that was one of the things, is like, when they brought up the, you know, if elections are vulnerable, I was skeptical. So I think democracy is pretty safe in the United States. That was my position. I just think we need on the stuff that we've learned about autocratic legalism and democratic backsliding. I mean, I didn't see why it couldn't be, you know, introduced, like, all the threats known to be posed by autocratic legalism can't fit within a political science curriculum, within, like, a U.S. government curriculum or some other high school or college curriculum in a class. So the state of U.S. democracy, I think, is pretty safe, pretty safe.
It depends largely on the outcome, because, I mean, normally I'm not one to be partisan in my analysis, but, I mean, in this case, there's a clear, like, difference, because in the case of, say, Trump, for example, I mean, he's outright said that he's terminating the Constitution and ruling as a dictator from day one. I mean, he said that in an interview with Sean Hannity about a month ago. And so, I mean, this is, like, actually, like, an existential election for the survival of, like, this is an existential threat, depending on how the election goes. And so if one candidate wins, it could be, like, the death knell of U.S. democracy with all the attendant consequences. Or alternatively, if the other candidate wins, then, in fact, the system putters on with all the vulnerabilities it has. I mean, I mean, in order for a two-party system to remain a democratic system, there has to be like bipartisan buy-in to the whole concept that election results are sacred, you can't overturn them, that in effect, democracy is non-negotiable in effect. And unfortunately, and I say unfortunately as a former Republican, a large swath of the Republican Party just doesn't believe in that anymore. And the only way that's going to likely change is if like the Trumpian wing of the party suffers a cataclysmic defeat in the elections, because at that point the party leadership will be pretty much forced to pretty much, you know, move back towards the center and the middle. And so whether or not, you know, this the viability of American democracy survives is largely contingent on like if Trump loses and how much.
I think pretty similarly to Conrad, I am often more partisan in what I'm doing. I am, as Conrad said, he's a former Republican. I was never a Republican. I'm more independent, but so yeah, like I think that there's a decent chance if Trump gets reelected that there's a world in which American democracy starts to face pretty heavy challenges from his administration. I think, on the other hand, if Biden becomes president, that, as Conrad said, the American democracy will more or less just keep on puttering on the way it is. I have slightly more hope if the Democrats can get one or two more seats in the Senate. There's a chance they might be able to pass some laws that I think might strengthen American democracy. Though I do fear that certain zones of authoritarianism, like Wisconsin, could end up like spreading even more. I think both Texas and Florida are trying out some things that I heavily disagree with in the field of like trying to make their states more independent, more authoritarian.
Something also that is also germane is also the question of like whether or not Trump will even be on the ballot, because of course there's currently like, you know, a whole bunch of court cases that the Supreme Court has agreed to review. And of course that kind of raises the question, like, you know, is it proper to remove someone from the ballot? Because that's on the face of it like an anti-democratic choice, because you're in effect disqualifying a popular candidate. But on the other hand, if that candidate has, you know, threatened the democratic process, you know, is that then justifiable to preserve democracy over the long run? That's kind of the whole question of like fortify democracy as a concept. And so I don't know, it's intriguing to say the least.
There's also the issue of if we do ban him, do his supporters turn to alternate methods of gaining power? As if they can't go through electoralism, what answer is there? Which is my fear. When I wrote a paper over Greece for autocratic legalism, and they did ban political parties there recently, and the kind of the biggest fear for banning entire political movements is if they can't do electoralism, what do they turn to?
Before I can let you go, there's this question that I pose to all my interviewees, which is, what are the one or two key readings or resources that you would recommend for a fellow student or any other listener who would be interested in learning more about these issues that we discussed here today?
I mean, in terms of like just reading materials, I mean, I would recommend the book The Pandemic of Populists by Siderski, because that was an assigned reading for, you know, Dr. Silva's class, and it was really useful because it very quickly and, you know, accessible English explains like how constitutional law and also the legal system has been used in a variety of different case studies of the last decade to, you know, erode democratic governance and also individual rights. And so for readers who want to get into this without having to like wade through like, you know, thick academic articles, Siderski's Pandemic of Populism is probably like the best entry level text. Like, I literally gifted, like, so like the copy of the book I got for class, I actually re-gifted that as a Christmas gift to my grandparents, because they're interested in reading politics, and but they also don't really have a formal background on it, and so, or so on, like this topic of authoritarian backslide.
I would say more for this project, a previous guest, Tom Ginsburg's book, How to Save a Constitutional Democracy, It was also co-written with Isis Huck. Yeah. And some of the other works by Ginsberg were pretty foundational to the idea of trying to use legal methods to stop authoritarian legalism.
So the Kim Lane Chappelle article is where I started. I found a good article about education, and it was from, I think, Carol D. Lee. I can send you an email with all the references. And it was about civics in public education, the role of civics in public education, and basically we're lacking. There's a lot more stuff we should teach kids for them to be prepared for the world today. And I think that's reflected in all the news we see about public schools, the high suicide rates among teens, all the drugs and all the problems that we have in schools. And we're not preparing the youth for everything that they meet in life today. So I think civic education should be better. I also looked a lot into populism. I think that was part of our class discussion, when you came and taught the class, a lot of these, it's referenced that they start off with populist movements. And so I read another article by John Levi Martin, James P. Murphy, and Rick Moore about protest movements and citizen discontent. It compares Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party. I kind of used 2008 as a point in time reference for when I saw populism start rising in the United States, and a lot of the autocratic legalism has been tied to populism. So I looked into populism and found a lot of interesting stuff that attempts to explain why people do the things that they do, and how movements and how these become popular. I got into some sociology and political science type stuff, and like most people, what some of these authors were saying is most people vote against things. Like people don't we don't vote in support, but like people are voting against what they don't like, not what they like. Like what they'll ultimately take isn't what they're thinking of. It's just not what they don't like, you know.
Conrad Sartorius, Caleb Weisinger, David Titano, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having us. If you ever need us or want to bring us back on, we'll gladly do it.
Yeah, thank you for having us. I hope to have another class with you.
Yeah, it's been great to be on here. I hope I make some kind of sense. Yeah, it was interesting. It was good times.
If you like this series, please share it with your friends on social media. They can access our episodes on the main podcast platforms or on our website. And if you have any feedback to our episodes or to our projects, please drop me a note at fabio.desaiasilva@ou.edu.